All right, welcome, folks. This is Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com and Brighteon.tv. And today we've got a great guest joining us who is a host on Brighteon.tv. He writes for Christian Living Magazine. He spent 30 years in corporate training. He's an executive coach, corporate trainer. He writes for websites like Uncover DC with Tracy Beans. And he also has his own website called TrueIdahoNews.com. And he's also, well, a couple of things I'll mention later. But his name is Dr. Daniel Bobinski, and he joins us now. And Dr. Bobinski, it's an honor to have you on. Thank you for all that you do. I really look forward to our conversation.
Well, thanks for having me on, and thank you for all that you do, making sure Brighteon works.
Well, absolutely. It doesn't work 100% all the time, though. We're doing our best. You know how that goes. We try. But I wanted to start out with you, because here we are. We're just about a couple of weeks away from the midterms. Mm-hmm. So even though politics is not your sole focus by any means, I want to ask you, what's your sense of the pulse of what's happening in America culturally, spiritually, and how will that translate, do you think, in the way people demand accountability during elections?
Whoa. Okay, there's a half an hour conversation.
Okay, sorry. I could start with something. No, just take your best shot at it. We'll go from there.
Sure. Well, culturally, I think people have started to wake up. You have the woke and then you have the awake. And I think it's great that we were able to turn that around, because the woke thought that they were all that in a bag of chips when they said that we weren't woke and they were. And then we just said, well, we're awake and you're not. And I think that's very, very true. And pushing that, though, I think is a lot of the spirituality, because people who are born-again Christians, people who follow the Lord, are saying, you know what? We have to speak truth. We are committed to the Lord. He is truth. He's not just, you know, that he's truthful. He is truth. And people are committed to, therefore, promoting truth. So they're speaking truth, and they're being bold about it. And it's really interesting how, I believe it was Mr. Marx who said that religion was the opium of the masses, and that's why they don't like having Christians around, because, well, quite frankly, we don't care if you put us to death, because to die is gain, right? So we're pretty bold about saying what we want to say, and we're not falling asleep as much as the Marxists would like for us to believe. We're not content. We are actually standing up and saying, no, bring us truth. We want truth. And we've seen a lot of lies in politics right now. People are getting away with it.
I was wondering, has something changed dramatically where you think people are more prone to demand the truth now than they were, let's say, before the whole COVID scenario or before the 2020 election? Or what's been the changing point in your view?
I think leadership from Donald Trump.
Really?
I think people saw someone finally stand up and tell the liars where to stick it. And they said, you know what, if he can do it, we can do it. Because they've sensed it for a long, long time.
So that was encouraging then, but then there's also the backlash side of that, which is that ever since Donald Trump started speaking, then the censorship of the left and big tech platforms and so on has also gone into the stratosphere, including censorship of Christians now. So it's almost like Christians, aren't they forced into a position where you either have to surrender to the censorship or you have to take a stand in righteousness and demand truth at any cost?
And to that I say, this is why Brighteon is such an important platform, because here we can speak the truth. The alternative economy is starting to emerge. People are starting to say, you know what, we can't survive if we stay in this economy of lies, economy of suppression. So you have places like Brighteon, places like Gab, Truth Social, whatnot, where people can speak up and say truth without getting censored. Heck, I still have a Facebook page. I keep in touch with relatives, and I will post stuff from time to time. Mike, I got suspended just for quoting the Surgeon General of the state of Florida.
Oh, of course.
I was told that what I posted was harmful. And I'm thinking, since when is what I'm posting here, what he's saying, harmful? It's backed up with facts, and yet they don't want us to talk about that. And that, I think, if you're driven for truth, you're wanting to share truth, and so you're going to go to places where truth is told. And like I said, Brighteon is a place that that happens.
Well, with Facebook, if you had only said, hey, children, chemically castrate yourselves, that would have been considered not harmful.
Isn't that funny?
Right? Not harmful. You know, experiment with scalpels and genitalia, not harmful. But when you say something like, maybe you don't need to wear a mask, that's harmful.
It's really sad considering, you know, peer-reviewed studies show, and you can cite science all day long, but if it's not their science, then they don't want to hear it. And that's not how science works, but
Sure. This
is the fight.
So, well, let me ask you this. So you write for Christian Living Magazine. What kinds, this is the first time that we've ever spoken, by the way, and I'm so glad. I mean, thank you for taking the time so we could do this and introduce you to our audiences here as well, those that haven't seen you yet on the platform. But what kinds of stories do you write for Christian Living Magazine?
Well, for years I wrote cultural stuff, talking about the culture from a Christian perspective, and I was pushing the envelope, and probably, you know, a lot of the people who read that magazine are pastors, and it gets distributed through churches. It's a free publication. It's supported by its advertisers. But it goes out, and I have to confess, I was starting to criticize the church because I think the church is not doing its job. It's not stepping up and not using the pulpit in a way that speaks truth. I think people are just succumbing. And I thought, okay, I'm probably not ought to offend a bunch of Christian pastors here. Let me talk about something more positive. And so for the past several years, I started writing about love because I've been teaching on love for decades. About 30 plus years ago, if I may, I was praying. I was a relatively new believer. It was late 80s, early 90s, and I'm praying and I'm going, okay, God, there's 613 laws. Which ones are the most important? What are the priorities? And he led me to the scripture that says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, strength, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those are two commandments. All the law and all the prophets hang on those two commands. And so for the past couple years, I've been writing just on that, because I think if all the law and all the prophets hang on those two commands, then by Jove, let's focus on those and let's get those down.
Well, that's going to open up a fascinating conversation here for sure. I mean, I love to delve into philosophy, so let's go down that rabbit hole just a little bit. So how do you practice love with discernment? Because even the left says unconditional love means, a grown man can love a child. And that's love, man-boy love, they call it, right? So in their vernacular, that's love. But of course, you and I would disagree with it. So how do you practice love with discernment?
Well, I think that is going to boil down to the definitions of love and the different types of love. Part of the problem with translations is that they tend to be, you've heard the phrase lost in translation.
Sure.
That's a good way to apply the word love, because there's several Greek words that are very different and have different meanings that when they get translated as love. For example, storge is a Greek word which means family love, like a love that a father has for a son or something like that. An eros would be an erotic love, a kind of love that a husband might have for his wife. But agape love is the love that God has for us, and it's a love of choice. And what's so funny is, you know, Jesus is asked by an attorney of all things who's trying to trap set him. And he says, what's the greatest commandment? And he says, well, it's to love the Lord. And then later in scripture, his disciples ask Jesus, well, how do we show you that we love you? And he says, obey my commands. And I joke and I say, it's kind of like going to the dictionary and looking up the word rutabaga and finding it says, see turnip. And then you go look up turnip and it says, see rutabaga. And it's like, wait, what?
Right.
Thankfully, the Apostle Paul gave us a really good definition in 1 Corinthians. And it's the same word that Jesus used, the same Greek word, agape, love of choice. And 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4, 5, 6, and 7 spell it all out with verbs of what to do and what not to do. And it just so happens that I've been writing about this in this magazine, and I'm actually putting the finishing touches on a book, which I've decided to call Love Like Jesus. and that book should come out next month. But it takes all those what to do's and the what not to do's and explores them from the angles of God being our example, because he is love. And then how do we love God? And then how do we love ourselves? And then love our neighbors. A lot of folks have a problem with that. Love yourself. But there it says right there in 1 Corinthians, love your neighbor as yourself. So we explore that.
Okay, so that book is called, again, Love Like Jesus. It's coming out in a month or so, you said?
Should be out around Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay, great. And that's going to be at your website, keeptherepublic.us?
That's true. It will be there. It will be available there.
Okay, great. So let me ask you then about forgiveness, because love and forgiveness must go hand in hand. And let me just present a conundrum to you. So let's suppose you have a neighbor, and the neighbor steals your Amazon packages off your porch. And you say, okay, you stole my Amazon packages. I know I caught you on my video. I forgive you. Okay. And then a week later, the neighbor comes over, steals your Amazon packages, and kicks your dog. And you're like, okay, dog's still okay. I forgive you. You stole the Amazon. You kicked the dog. Okay, I forgive you. And then, you know, third week, the same neighbor, right, comes over, kicks the dog, steals the Amazon, sets your car on fire. Is there, you know, at what point do you just shoot your neighbor? You know what I mean? I mean, when is that boundary in the spiritual world?
Well, that's a very good question, because that's one of the controversies we actually address in the book, because there's a passage in that selection where it says, love keeps no record of wrongs. And that is the new international version. If you look at the King James version, it says, love thinketh no evil. So how do you reconcile those two passages? That's the translation for the same Greek word.
Wow.
Thinketh no evil and keeps no record of wrongs. And you would think, and this is one of the biggest joys that I found in digging into the original language here, because the Greek word used there is a future connotation.
Huh.
So if I could put it in the Bobinski translation, it's, I am not going to think of ways of how I'm going to get back at you or do evil toward you. I am commanded to forgive you. Bible is replete with that. I'm commanded all the time to forgive, forgive, forgive. Nowhere will you find in Scripture where Jesus tells us to forget. Uh-huh. So when we hear pastors misteach out of that passage where it said, they say, keep no record of wrongs, just forget of how people have wronged you. No, not at all. The word is a future connotation. I am to forgive you, but that doesn't mean I'm supposed to forget, because I need to set a boundary that protects me from getting hurt by you again in the future.
Exactly. And this goes for ethnicities. This goes for nations. I mean, this is throughout history. So you had, you know, entire countries being attacked by, let's say, Adolf Hitler, what have you. And, you know, the country has a right to say no and to enforce that and to basically say, pardon my language, but hell no, you're not coming into our town and taking our homes and, you know, capturing our people and things like that, right?
Right. In no way was Jesus ever a doormat.
Yes, exactly. But this is like finding that balance is the real art of living, isn't it?
Well, here, and again, we address this in the book, but it's you have the Holy Spirit. If you're a Christian and you've invited the Holy Spirit in, the Bible's pretty clear that God is love. So you already have the Holy Spirit, love, agape love, living within you. So how do we do that? We need his help. We can't do it on our own strength. So it's like, okay, God, let me tend the soil of my heart so that your love can grow within me. And I have to obviously focus and study and strive to understand, but I can't do it on my own strength.
So you believe that if people invite God to help guide them in their decisions, that they will increasingly come to the right choice in these difficult moral situations? I guess that answers itself almost, doesn't it?
But, yes.
I'm just wondering on a practical matter, you know, how people do that effectively. You were a corporate trainer. Was this part of what you taught people in making difficult moral decisions in a corporate environment?
You're making me laugh here because I got mentored before coaching was called coaching. So late 80s, I met a gentleman. He was actually a Messianic Jew. And he taught me a lot of these things. The love thing God showed me, but he taught me a lot about the principles that I use in my teaching and coaching. And so I was doing teaching and coaching, and I would weave this stuff into my training and coaching. But I would find ways to do it with secular terminology.
Uh-huh, right.
And people would come up to me on breaks, and they would say, wow, this is really powerful stuff. Where do you get this? And then you get to share the gospel with them, right?
Yeah, right.
But then you have some people. I had one guy come up to me one time and say, this sounds a lot like what I hear in church on Sundays.
Well, what do you know? Well, did you ever do, I mean, I imagine if you did corporate training for 30 years, at many times you must have been invited into environments where profit was the motive above all, like a Wall Street firm or something, a hedge fund. It's like, you know, it's all about the dollars. Like, screw everybody else, you know. That kind of mentality is out there. How do you work with that?
Great question, and it is an issue because a lot of companies want to focus on the bottom line. The issue can be resolved, I think, by reading a very simple book. And it's a Greek guy, and I'm forgetting how to pronounce his last name, but his first name is Nikos, and I think it's Morganius or something like that. But the title of his book is Purpose. The book's probably about 20 years old, but he talks about four different types of purposes that a company can have, and that they are moral purposes. But when a company starts focusing only on the money, that is an amoral purpose. It's not an immoral purpose. It's just amoral. There is no weighting of morals to it. It's just not focusing on a moral dilemma. And when companies start to focus on the bottom line only, and they only focus on the dollar, that's when you look through history, that's when companies start to fail. As long as they stay focused on other purposes, then they do well. And to your question, there are two types of consultants. There's a type of consultant that goes into a business and looks at the books in the back room and comes out after a couple hours and says, here's what you need to do to make your business successful. That's not me.
Right.
I'm the kind of guy that walks into the business and goes to the front of the room, and I look at who's working with who and who's in what positions, and after a couple hours, I come out and say, okay, here's the training you need for these people to learn these things, and here's who you need to move in order for your business to be successful.
Right, right. You're looking at the people as the drivers, not the accounting.
If people are our greatest assets, and most every company says that, but do they really put their money behind those words? A lot of them don't. They say it, but if people are really our greatest assets, then we need to invest in our people. And as Zig Ziglar used to say, 80% of people get promoted because of their people skills, not because of their technical skills.
That's a really interesting point. And yeah, I would agree with that as well. There are a lot of really qualified, brilliant people who are very introverted in a corporate environment. And it's easy to miss their contributions or their brilliance.
Mm-hmm. And if they focus too much on technical stuff and not enough on the interpersonal stuff, when you're in management and leadership, that which you're in charge of really is the people. That's what your raw product is, really. That's what you need to become expert in. In fact, they've done studies on this. In middle management positions, two-thirds of the difference between an average performer and a top performer is emotional intelligence. And I'm not talking about the difference between a poor performer and a top performer. I'm talking between an average performer and a top performer. And at leadership levels, it's even higher. Four-fifths of the difference for leaders is emotional intelligence. And when I say emotional intelligence, I've had clients go, I don't want to study emotions. That's all a bunch of wishy-washy stuff. And I'm going, yeah, let me define that. The Bobinski definition of emotional intelligence is the ability to perceive and assess our own and other people's emotions, desires, and tendencies, and then make the best decision in the moment to get the best result for everybody. That's the simplest, the very simplistic, very practical approach to emotional intelligence.
Okay, and that is something that has to be learned via experience and sensitivity and empathy, and that, I mean, that's hard to teach academically. You don't just go through a course and suddenly you're good at that.
No, as a matter of fact, I have to tell you, the courses that I teach are normally 6 months long, if I'm doing them right. If somebody wants to compress them, we can do them in 3 months, but you cannot turn a culture around in a weekend workshop. And some folks, you just can't do it.
Really? Not even on Wall Street? What was that movie with the crazy guy? And they had like the hookers, and they had the little people they were throwing on target boards. The Wolf of Wall Street. That's what I'm thinking. They were trying to turn it around with one cocaine-laced party. And yeah, I guess it didn't work.
I tell people, how long have you been having this problem? Oh, about 5 years. Oh, and you wanted me to turn it around in a weekend.
Okay. Okay. All right. Sorry if I'm sounding a little radical with some of my metaphors here, but you know, my job is to stimulate discussion here. So let me ask the next question. Then in a corporate environment, if you don't mind talking about this, what is the psychological cost or damage or erosion that takes place when meritocracy is abandoned in the name of wokeness, where, let's say, people of a certain skin color, i.e. Caucasians, suddenly feel like they're no longer allowed to advance in a company because they don't check off the right check boxes because it's a woke culture, and suddenly it doesn't matter how good you are, how brilliant you are, what your contributions are, you have to be the right color, the right sexual orientation, and so on and so forth. Have you seen that happen in companies?
I've read about it, Mike. I actually refuse to do business with companies that want to pursue that line.
Okay.
I have had a person who wrote a book on diversity in the way that you're describing it. And the person also had other skills and trainings. And so I actually brought this person along one time to do some co-training with me. And then I went over the different ways that I teach emotional intelligence. And at the end of the day, this person who had written a book on diversity on the drive back to the office says to me, you know, what you're teaching is the real diversity. I'm going, different personality styles, different ways to perceive, different ways to process, different ways to make decisions, different ways to approach problems. That's the diversity that we should be focusing on.
Right.
Because that's where people are. And I can point it. Doesn't matter what your skin color is. Doesn't matter what their gender is.
No, it's diversity of ideas, it's diversity of approaches, and it's a diversity of people's life experiences that they're applying to try to solve the current problem. And everybody's got a different experience, so they're going to approach things differently. And you're right. I mean, you got to look past the surface of just what's visible. I mean, it's almost like, hey, turn off the lights. Let's talk with the lights off. We don't even need to see anybody. We can ask questions and determine how people think, how people approach problems. Have you ever had like a lights out type of coaching experience?
Actually, no, and I don't, and probably won't, because I teach that 68% of your communication is body language.
Well, okay. All right. That's a good zinger right there, but what about just cognitive diversity, you know, the different thought processes that people go through?
Yeah, that's what we really cover. And it's teaching people how to listen. But and I actually teach a lot of what my coach taught me, and I've systematized it and I've added to it so much over the years. But there's really three basic steps, and it's self-management, which starts with self-awareness. So you have self-awareness, self-management. And then you have work management, and then you have people management. And so many people want to start with the people management, and you really can't do a good job of that unless you first understand yourself and what your strengths and blind spots are. And one of the biggest ahas that I have to help people understand is that every strength has a corresponding weakness.
Uh-huh.
I can point to any person on a team and say, here's where this person is strong, very valuable to the team. And here's where that strength is a weakness for the team. And so once we become aware of that, we can manage better, manage ourselves better. People say, are there certain styles better than another? Is there a good or a bad? I say, no. There's more effective or less effective in a given situation, but not good or bad. So it's simply a matter of knowing which style is needed for success in that situation and bringing that person or those people to the fore.
Now, people like to imagine that their egos never get involved in their decision making. And also, I think if you have a room of 100 people, 70 of them think they're above average. And, talk to us about, it's important to love yourself and to accept yourself. But also, I'm curious about this. Do you find that people overestimate their strengths in these environments?
I'm going to say some do and some don't. I encounter a lot of people who, and maybe I should caveat this, Mike, just to say that it depends on who comes to me for help. I think, when the pupil is ready, the teacher arrives kind of thing. I've been blessed to have some really good people training me along the way. I've been blessed to be connected with some really good programs and learn a lot of really cool things. And one of the things that I think is important is for people to come to grips with their weaknesses. So one of the environments that I create early on is helping people understand that what got you there is not going to keep you there. You've got to become a lifelong learner. You've got to learn what your strengths and blind spots are. And I do it in a way, I think, that people buy in. My current method, just as an FYI, is we do 1 hour a week on a Zoom call, and they get a homework assignment. And we go 26 weeks. It's like two college classes.
Yeah, right.
But I guarantee results. Why? Because of the way that the teaching happens. And there's after my coach teaching me how to do it, and after 3 decades of practicing and finding out what works and what doesn't work well, I create those environments where people come to their own sense of need for help in a way that they don't feel criticized. That is the biggest thing. People are afraid of getting criticized. They're afraid of failure. They're afraid of losing out somehow. So when you can create an environment where they don't feel that, then they can become a little vulnerable and then they can grow.
That's really fascinating because, you're talking about a personal revolution of self that then feeds into the structure of the entire system of the company or the group or whatever it is. So that leads me to a question. Then the self-image is strongly influenced by messages from pop culture, from advertising, from peers and authority figures and so on. And one of the things that's been I think frustrating to people over the years is how much sort of the Hollywood pop culture imagery makes you feel bad about yourself if you don't have, the perfect waistline or the perfect fashion purse or, the perfect hairdo, whatever. There's always this message that you're not good enough if you subscribe to what's accepted in Hollywood and movies and pop culture and so on. Have you found, does that carry into people's this lack of self-image, even when they deserve a strong self-image because they are extraordinary people? Do you sometimes find they're lacking because of the messages from our information ecosystem?
I'm going to have to answer, I don't know, because I don't go there.
Oh.
I just don't. I deal with
people. It never comes up?
Well, I don't think it ever has. No, because I deal with people in an objective way, in that I give them some assessment tools. And people call them personality tests. I don't like that word, that phrase, because A, personality is huge. And second of all, the word test implies a right and wrong answer.
Right.
There's no right or wrong. It's who did God make you to be? And that's what we're trying to find out here. So they're really style assessments. So that's a behavioral style assessment, or a cognitive style assessment, or a motivational style assessment. And so I have them take the assessments, and I'm very careful in what assessments I use so that they're highly validated. They're not just off the wall, you know, internet tests. but you have an assessment that asks some people, it takes them 20 minutes to answer a series of questions. And then I ask them to read it and to tell me how accurate they think it is.
Wait, after they've answered it themselves?
After they've answered the questions and they get their results, the computer system kicks out the results. I say, go ahead and read it. Tell me how accurate you think it is.
Yeah.
And I give them permission. I say, look, you can cross off anything here you disagree with after you check with your spouse and your coworkers first.
Oh, interesting.
Because if you're reading something and you go, no, that's not me, I disagree. Okay, well, you can cross it off, but you got to go to your spouse or your coworkers and say, is this me? And if they go, no, that's not you, then go ahead and cross it off. But if they go, oh, no, that's you, then you got to keep it.
Okay. Wow, that takes a lot of courage, I think, to go around and ask the people close to you, is this me? They're like, yeah, totally. That's you every day.
And then they get their eyes opened. And the biggest aha that I had, I'm going to go back 30 years. The biggest aha that I had was coming to grips with my weakness. I didn't want any. When my mentor gave me the assessments, I'm looking at these going, I'm screaming, no, no. I did not want those weaknesses. I just want strengths. And coming to grips with the fact that I had weaknesses was one of the hugest steps of growth for me.
Well, but that's almost the definition of growth, isn't it? I mean, that's, that, or at least integral to it. But what, can we take this, let's try a little practical thing here for our audience. I mean, I don't want to suppose that something super valuable can be offered here in 60 seconds, but do you have any overall kind of guidelines for people or tips for people or point them in the right direction about how they can improve their lives with the people around them, or where can they start to look for answers that can help them?
Well, I always use two books. And if you people want resources, that's probably a good place to start. The problem with books, Mike, is that people read them and they don't discuss them and therefore they don't implement them. When I taught at Idaho State University, I taught for 3 years this material. I was asked by a department, they had gone to the business school and they said, hey, we're looking for this kind of class for our managers, and business department said, man, we don't have it. And so they came to me and said, can you develop a class? And I said, sure. So for 3 years before I moved off to the side of the state, I was teaching over there as an adjunct. And two books that I used, one, Stephen Covey's book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
Oh, sure, a classic.
Because it outlines, in very theoretical terms, but it outlines the basic format of emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. And the second book that I'm going to recommend is a little self-serving, but it's my book called Creating Passion-Driven Teams.
Oh.
And you can find it on Amazon, I think, right now. And it's a good book of experience of what I saw working in teams after decades of working with teams. What is the common thread among all these teams that I see that are successful? And so I sat down and analyzed it. And I joke with people, like the second chapter, if they were making a movie of it, it'd be like me working at my desk at 2 o'clock in the morning and the desk would start glowing, because I found this very simple way to explain how workplaces work. And between those two books, Creating Passion-Driven Teams and then 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, I would recommend people start there. And join a discussion group.
I'm going to have to get this book, your book, from my team. then, because we are at the size, you know, we're a big enough organization that communication is a challenge to make sure the right people are in the right meetings, but not too many people, you know, not everybody has to be here.
That's huge. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm going to get your book. Also, I want to mention for you folks listening, if you want to support Dr. Babinski's work here, not only can you buy his book, but another thing you can do is you can shop at brightonstore.com and you can use his discount code, which is KTR, which stands for Keep the Republic. You use his discount code, you get a small discount, and then there's a little bit of revenue that goes to Dr. Daniel Babinski and his efforts as well. So again, brightonstore.com, KTR is the discount code, or check out his books and the one that's coming up soon, Love Like Jesus, right?
Yes.
Okay, great. So let's see, creating passion-driven teams and Love Like Jesus. What's the third? Yeah, I mean, what's coming next?
Well, actually, I'm probably letting the cat out of the bag on this one.
It's okay.
But Alan Keyes and I are working on a book.
Oh, I love it already.
So I'll just leave it at that. How's that?
Okay, I'm just going to have to guess. This is the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Moral History of the United States.
Close, but no.
Is it?
It's more future. It's more future focused.
Oh, okay, okay. Gosh, well, Dr. Keyes is such a historian. He's so knowledgeable about the founders and everything. But okay, but it's got to do with obviously a moral basis for humanity.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
Okay. All right. I get a point. All right. All right. That's all I'm going to press you on that one. We'll wait for the news. You didn't know you're going to get, you know, hit with like an interrogation on this show, did you?
That's
like,
all right.
Tell us, give us one word, one hint. Can I buy a vowel?
You can buy the word 2024 election.
Ah, okay. I like it. All right. 2024. Okay. Well, are there any other thoughts you want to leave us with as we wrap this up? I mean, it's already been really interesting, but what else is on your mind to share?
Well, I just want to encourage people, like I do on my shows quite a bit, to get involved at the precinct level. The way that our country was established, the way it's all set up, it really is a bottom-up function. We spend a lot of time talking about and getting involved on stuff that's at the national level, our state representatives and our state senators, but then our federal U.S. senators, U.S. reps, and the president and all that. That's what gets all the flashy headlines and the flashy news. But I believe that this society has lost so much ground because people have abdicated the local politics. They gave up the school boards. Somebody's got that. They gave up the city councils. Somebody's got that. And now those seats are filled with socialists. And they're arguing in favor of socialism. And now we're having to try to win that ground back.
Good point.
So to me, that is where the fight really is. One of the guests I've got coming up on my show, either this week or next, is a gal who went through a master's program to get her psychology degree, and they wanted her to sign this big social justice thing, that's what she needed to focus on. And she, with several classes left to go to get her degree, she dropped the program.
Well, that's some kind of loyalty pledge to wokeism. That's crazy.
Yeah, but that's how badly our society has become corrupt. So if we're going to win this country back, it's going to have to happen at the grassroots level. And so I encourage people to find the most conservative, constitutionally minded Christian folks you can find and get the people who are willing to run. And sometimes those that don't want to run, because sometimes they're the best candidates, and help them run and help them get elected so that we can get a majority and take back the wokeism that's ever encroaching in our small little towns.
Yeah, well said. And by the way, when is your show on Brighton.tv?
It is on Thursday afternoons. Keep the Republic airs at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific.
Okay, great. Thursday afternoons. All right, well, Dr. Babinski, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I know we've only scratched the surface, but you have a rich depth of material, and I want to encourage people to check out your website, keeptherepublic.us, check out your book, Creating Passion-Driven Teams, and also then get ready for what you've got coming out next with Alan Keyes.
I think it's going to be interesting. Fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been fun. And
thanks for having me. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, absolutely. And for those of you listening, as always, feel free to repost this interview if you'd like, or snippets from it. And you can put it on your own channel or other platforms as well, because we believe in sharing ideas and freedom of speech. So, again, it was Dr. Daniel Babinski at keeptherepublic.us. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon, the platform that I built so we can have discussions just like this one. Thank you for listening. God bless you all. God bless America. Take care.